God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Welcome, everybody, to The Christian Optimist. My name is Pastor Rafe Chenery. I'm your host. I'm here today with...
Joshua Freed.
We're excited to be back with you after a one-week break over New Year's. We've got a great one for you today. We're going to be digging into a Yahoo News article that came out. Actually, Yahoo just reported on a study that had come out. Many agencies reported on this study about the differences biologically and chemically between men and women. So brace yourselves. Actually, before we jump in here, I want to say a few words on this topic as a bit of a precursor. Sometimes I know when I jump into, you know, what we might call, quote, controversial topics, one of the questions I get is, why do I jump into these topics, right? We're going to be talking about the differences of men and women. Obviously, there's a lot of areas to really make some people upset that we're even talking about the differences of men and women. So why would I take time on a podcast to speak into an issue like this that is certainly going to, you know, raise some hairs on in the hearts of people that feel differently than I do, or maybe have never been equipped on this before? Here's why. As a pastor in Chicago, one of the greatest works I believe God has assigned me to do, as well as all pastors, is to help Christians living in a world that is attacking every biblical idea, whether that's what is a man, what is a woman, what is a child, what is a life, what is the government. All these ideas that we're discussing are under attack, and they have biblical principles. There are premises which the Bible speaks of them. And as a pastor, my heart is to equip Christians to think about the Bible and what the Bible says on all these issues. And so when it comes to a topic like men and women and what are the differences between men and women, the Bible has a lot to say on this. And so as a pastor, I don't want to shy away from these differences. Rather, what I want to do is I want to teach on them, because I believe that God's design of men and women is the most beautiful way you could possibly live your life. Not only beautiful, but it's the most natural way, meaning the way God's designed us will bring the greatest fulfillment if we know what He's designed and how He's designed it. And so as a pastor, one of the reasons I step into these areas that are, quote, controversial is simply because they're controversial. That's why they're controversial, because people are raging against God's design. That's what makes them controversial. And so I want to expose the Bible. I want to see, what does God say on this? How does He say we should relate to each other? What are the differences between us? And if we're going off in society in the wrong direction, how do we correct it? And how do Christians lead the way in that correction? So with that said, there's one other thing I want to say on this, and I'm going to say it up front, probably come back to this again a little later on. Whenever I talk about the differences between men and women, there is one huge pitfall that I want to avoid right up front, and that is this. Throughout history, men have utilized some of the language that I may be using today and twisted and distorted the language to demand submission of women and to abuse women. That is not foreign to me, that has been something that's happened throughout history. In fact, some of our listeners may have even had men abuse, twist scripture sinfully to abuse women, to effect some kind of domineering position over women, to harm women, to abuse women, to do all sorts of terrible things throughout history. I don't need to repeat all of those, but I do want to acknowledge that up front, that if the doctrine that I'm speaking of today, that the Bible explains with clarity and with great love, if this is twisted, like all doctrine, once you take a scripture and you twist it and you try to make it mean something it doesn't mean, the fruit of that will be terrible fruit that harms women. And I lament that, unfortunately, the Bible has been twisted by people in the past. And so I recognize that if you are listening to this and you have harm, or you've been harmed in the past, or you're carrying bitterness, or you're carrying some kind of, anger in your heart, even thinking that a pastor is about to talk about the differences between men and women because of the way this has been abused in the past in your life, can I just tell you, please reach out to me or to Josh or to a faithful pastor who can help navigate that for you. This is meant to encourage and equip and lift up and paint a beautiful picture of what this could be. But for some of you, it might be that the first work that needs to be done is not painting a beautiful picture, but healing some of the wounds that you have. And so reach out to me directly. I want to be a part of that and connect you with some folks who can help you biblically so that we can restore ultimately a really beautiful picture. Okay, with that, that's my preface. I mean everything I just said. We are going to be jumping into the topic of complementarianism. And that has to do with the way men and women differ in God's design. So let me start us off with this article I came across. The one I'm going to be reading is from Yahoo News. The title is this: Women are more empathetic than men. Study of hundreds of thousands of people finds at any age and in any country in the world. So let me read to you some quotes from this article. Here's from that article particularly. It reads this: It was already common knowledge that women are better than men at placing themselves in other people's shoes. But now science backs up that statement. Empathy, the ability to understand, imagine, or share the emotions others may be feeling, is a critical characteristic to have in pretty much every avenue of life, especially in businesses. Well, you can kind of see the direction that Yahoo is taking with this already. What they've done with this is they're recognizing what the study says, that that empathy is a stronger characteristic in general among women, as the research has found, and then they're applying it in the business setting and showing how this can be used towards women's advantage in the marketplace. In another news article, neuroscience.news.com, the title of this article was "Females on Average Perform Better Than Males on a, quote, Theory of Mind Test Across 57 Countries." Dr. Carrie Allison, Director of Applied Research at the Autism Research Center at Cambridge University, here's quoting from the article, and a member of the team said, "This study clearly demonstrates a largely consistent sex difference across countries, languages, and ages. This raises new questions for future research about the social and biological factors that may contribute to the observed, on average, sex difference in cognitive empathy." Okay, so we're going to do a few things with this, and first I'm going to hand over to Josh in just a second. But here's where we're going to go with this. The article in general is saying there was this huge international cross-cultural study that was done on measuring certain things, but the differences between men and women. And one of the takeaways from this study that was done across 57 countries is that 100% of the time, women, on average, across all these cultures, are scoring higher in empathy, in cognitive empathy, than men are, and majority of the time scoring far higher than men are. That's the big takeaway that these scientific journals are finding. Now, Josh, actually, you dug into a little bit of the test itself. Can you briefly, because I want to go in here quickly, can you explain, you had a couple of issues with the test itself and how it was conducted and what this research shows. So I don't want to go too long on this to belabor this point, but This is one of the things I love about Josh is you can't get anything by this guy. You look into it. You make sure we're on our toes. So you had some problems with the test itself. What did you see?
So before I even get into that, I just wanted to define one of the terms. So we use the term cognitive empathy, and there's two forms of empathy. There's affective empathy and cognitive empathy. First, affective empathy is when you look at someone and you look at their face, you can tell what they're feeling. That's affective empathy. And both men and women can be good at this. Women have a tendency to be better at this. On the other hand, cognitive empathy is to what extent a person can understand someone else's emotions and adopt their perspective to appreciate how something made them feel that way.
So let me just jump in there and say this. So the Yahoo News article, I'm going to quote them again, kind of summarizing what you just said. It says there are different types of empathy. Affective empathy, for instance, is the measure of someone's ability to share another person's emotions and feel what they feel. Think feeling sad when a friend tells you a distressing story. That's affective empathy. Then it says cognitive empathy, on the other hand, is to what extent a person can understand someone else's emotions and adopt their perspective to appreciate how something made them feel that way. Okay? All right, go ahead.
Yeah, so in this article, they're talking about the cognitive empathy aspect, and that's how do we share the feelings. So when I look into this article...
Well, actually, let me just make sure I go in here. So it's not just how we share the feelings. The cognitive empathy is then the ability to place yourself in that person, not just to share the feelings, but to place yourself in their shoes and almost experience how they interpreted an event the way they did.
Yeah.
That's what they're saying women have such a higher ability to do than men.
Mm-hmm.
All right, keep going.
So as I looked into this article, I took the tests that they were taking, and one, I scored higher than most women when it came to empathy. And two...
Cognitive empathy or affective empathy?
So they didn't distinguish between the two.
Interesting.
And so on the other hand, the test was looking at was, one, they're studying autism. And for most people who are autistic, they don't have the ability to have cognitive empathy.
So wait, you're saying the whole test itself. Now, I saw this in the it says up front the sponsors of the test were these big autism councils and medical officers. So the test itself was not designed to look for these kind of results. No. The test was about autism.
So it's, the test is comparing one's ability to empathize versus their ability to systematize. So, of course, empathizing is how do you place yourself in another person's shoes versus the systematizing is how do you order the world within your thoughts. And their deduction was that there's really three camps. There's technically five camps, but there's three main ones. Do you predominantly empathize with others, which tended more towards women? Do you predominantly systematize, which tends towards males? Or are you more balanced? And that was both and.
Okay, so let me just close that. And I'm so grateful you took the time to do that, because this is a very common thing that happens all the time. Now, the takeaway for us in these purposes is just simply to say the results that came out of this test were not actually what was being tested. Mm-hmm. That wasn't what was being tested. However, that doesn't mean that the results are not accurate. You still got these results from this test, and it was, I don't think it was surprising. That's the whole point of this. It's just scientifically backing what we already know. Excuse me. What I would say is that very often when I look through news articles and I see a scientific journal produce this results, you do have to do the work Josh just did. All the time, I see news articles saying journals have produced certain results that actually are not accurate. Mm-hmm. When you really look at the results, it said, sure, if you look at it through a certain lens, you can kind of say that's what it was saying, but that's not really it. That's to deny other aspects of the journal. All that to say, good work. Christians should be trained. Whenever you see an article like this, take 5 minutes, look at the study, and was it a strong study or a weak study? Was it set up well? Was it not set up well? All that to say, we've got some data here that I think is accurate and that aligns with something Christians would have said, of course, from the very, very beginning, and which basically everybody, except those on a very, very far extreme view, would say, yes, in general, this is reflecting a lived experience that people have known for thousands of years, that women in general are more empathetic than men. Now, what is that not saying? Do men not have empathy? Of course not.
It just shows itself in a different way.
It shows itself in a different way. And we're going to get to that in just a moment, what that looks like. What is the calling on men? And how do men show empathy? How did Jesus show empathy as the man, right? Like the quintessential man. How did he do this? But it does mean that in general, in a natural way, by God's design, women have a stronger empathy than men, which I would say helps them in the functions and primary roles that they've been assigned by God. And which in the functions and primary roles that men have been assigned by God, it actually helps them to not have as high a level of empathy. Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, let's work that out a little bit. So let's, in order to work that out a little bit, let's jump into the big split here. I would, for the sake of making things simple, there are essentially three big camps in Christianity. Actually, I'd say there's two big camps in Christianity. But then there's a third one that likes to claim itself for Christianity, which is not, okay? So within Christianity, there's two big views of looking at the roles of men and women in the church, in the family, and society at large. One is what I would hold to, what our church holds to, which is called complementarianism, which says that men and women are made equal image bearers of God, infused with dignity, with value, all of that, equal before God, and yet different in function. And what that means is different in their roles, in their functions, both within the home, within the church, and you can then extend that to society at large if you wanted to go in that direction, but particularly within the home, within the church, there's a difference in function. Egalitarianism, so that's what I just described as complementarianism, what we hold to and what I believe the Bible teaches with great clarity, which we'll show in this podcast today. But then there's this other view called, it's called egalitarianism, egal being that kind of root, form, kind of meaning equal, right? Meaning that those distinctive forms and roles are actually not so. That within the church and home, there's an equalness between men and women, which plays itself out in no distinguishment between roles, between functions. And that plays it out in a number of ways. So for example, one really practical way is who can be a pastor? Well, we would say qualified biblical men per the Bible, for 1 Timothy 3, Titus chapter 1, are who should function in the role of pastor, elder within a church. That's the primary leader and defender of the faith within a local church context. That's one of the forms and functions that have been assigned to men specifically. That's not that women can't exercise leadership in lots of different ways, but that role as head of the church is for qualified biblical men. Just like in the home, the role of head of the home is assigned to the husband, to the father. Again, not to say that women don't have leadership, that there's sacrificial service on both ends of this, love towards one another, equal image bearing before God, all that, yes. But the role of head and leadership is assigned to qualified men. Egalitarianism equalizes all of that, says there's no difference. And then what I would say is there's this newer branch that in extremely theologically liberal camps, what I would call hyper-liberalism, hyper-egalitarianism. Hyper-egalitarianism says not only are the forms and functions different, not only are the forms and functions the same between men and women, but there actually is no difference between men and women at all. And in that, there's almost a lunacy and absurdity to it because it really can't play itself out. This is where you see camps that are typically not within the Christian sphere, but in kind of a more hyper politically liberal sphere, saying things like, you know, Leah Thomas, the male swimmer who's crushing women in female sports a couple years ago, that there's no difference and there should be no distinguishment between men and women in female sports.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I think on face value, we can all say that's absurd and lunacy, simply by looking at the shoulders of the swimmer, right? Or, you know, to get more graphic, looking at the biological differences mm-hmm. of the men and women. And so that's a hyper end. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the roles of men and women in the church. Now, why is this culturally important? I think there's a handful of cultural reasons why pastors need to equip their flock to think biblically on this issue. Number one, there is an attack on men to be less manly. Now, when I say the word manly, I used that word manly years ago in a sermon, and I regret the way I used it. I was talking about Boaz, who I'm going to hopefully get to in this podcast a bit later on today and from the Bible, and I talked about how he was a manly man or a man's man. And I tried to preface this the right way, but it came off in the sermon as really celebrating toxic masculinity, which I don't think was anything I was trying to do. And so I want to say this very clearly. There is a biblical vision for masculinity, which is good. And men need to lean into. And today, there is an all-out attack on biblical masculinity and biblical manhood so that to suggest that there's a unique way that men particularly should respond and behave in society, in home, and to lean into those differences that make them men different from women is in some way toxic.
Yeah.
And that is a lie. And what happens when you, and I would go so far as to say there's an attempt to feminize men. And when you feminize men, you get into a lot of trouble. Society biblically begins to kind of fall apart when the men don't recognize the role they have in being men.
And one of the things that you'll notice is this really shifts from personality to role and responsibility. The biblical man is focused on a certain role and responsibility that he steps into. It doesn't relate to what type of personality does he have. Is he more empathetic? Is he more of a thinker or a feeler? They're two different things. Both men and women can have various personality types that influence how they act out their roles in the world. But if a man's more empathetic, that doesn't make him more effeminate. If a man cries listening to opera, that doesn't make him more feminine. What makes him masculine in the biblical sense is how does he act out those roles that God has given him?
It's beautiful. I agree fully. Now, not only is there an attack on men to be less manly, simultaneously, there is an attack on women to be less womanly.
Yeah, feminism has just utterly destroyed the biblical example of what women should be, and it demonizes.
Okay, you just dropped a big term there that's going to blow some people's minds, because in our culture today, if we haven't been trained to understand, feminism is probably, for a lot of folks, when they first hear that word, if they haven't been around this language for a while, they think of something positive. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you just said that, you talked about feminism in a negative way. Can you help us from a very ground level up. Why would you come away with a posture that feminism has had ultimately negative results?
All right. In a very brief way, I'm not talking about first wave feminism is that women should deserve rights and that they deserve to be treated as equal to men. I'm talking about second wave, which starts with like Simone de Beauvoir of France, who is saying that women have a certain degree of sameness, that it's bad if you're a woman who stays at home and doesn't empower yourself. It's bad if you're a stay-at-home mom because you're not living out your full potential. This is something that stems from a second wave feminism where women are lesser if they're not trying to be like men.
You nailed it. So, and if you're not familiar with this language, first, second, third wave feminism, this is describing seasons of feminist leaders and literature that have come out over the last century. First wave feminism, kind of those initial women who were voting for things, who were fighting for things like voting rights for women. Some of those early things where they were saying, look, there needs to be some more focus put on the rights of women. Some of those things as Christians, we can look back on and say, yeah, there's a lot of truth there.
Yeah.
There have been ways which women, and you can even look in countries around the world today where women truly are, in a sense, I want to say second class citizens, and intentionally, almost an abusive way. And you can say, yes, biblically, that's wrong. Biblically, it's not second class. There's differences, but there's equal beauty and dignity and value here. And so some of that first way, some of it, not all of it, but some of it, we could get behind as Christians and say, yeah, like, of course, we want to fight for the beauty and dignity and value of women. Where it began to go wrong is when they said, there's no difference. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, the way we're going to measure that there's no difference is when we see women in the workforce and women in all these different roles that men have historically held at equal degrees in numbers. So it's when it's a 50-50 marker of men and women in all of these different positions, then we'll know we're living in a truly equitable society. Now, that gets us into a whole lot of trouble, which we can, you know, well, we can talk about. Like here's a couple of instances where that might get us in trouble. Number one, there's a number of roles that women would have a hard time doing. Like, for example, working on an oil rig. Mm-hmm. These are just extreme examples to make a point. But there are certain branches of feminism that are saying, no, those should be equal as well. Have you ever seen a video of a man working on an oil rig and what he has to do?
Yeah, or even firefighters.
Firefighters. We can then talk about in the military. Joshua, you've served in the military. Yeah. And ground forces in the military. The number one function of a ground force military, the one thing they're measured by is vitality. Mm-hmm. Is their ability to kill.
Yeah.
And to function as a team. It is not about equity when it gets to the ground and you're being shot at. It's their ability to kill. And the data shows that when a woman is serving on a team, it's not that there's many things that cannot be done within the military. Absolutely not. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. But when it comes to on-ground forces fighting in a battle scenario, the data reports that when a female is joined into a team, the vitality levels significantly drop for that team for a number of reasons. One of them is that all the men want to care for the women yeah. more than they want to care for the other men in their team, and that ends up causing discrepancies in the choices they make.
And also another thing is if there's been results where a woman's gotten shot in combat and the men just break down and go berserk, and that can result in war crimes, or they might tend to the woman and then get themselves killed.
Now, there's two ways to look at this. When I brought this up before, I've had a number of folks say, how dare you say that? What I want to go back to is this article. And I want to say, actually, if we come at this from a biblical perspective, what we're going to say is there are differences between men and women that are natural and mm-hmm. good and wonderful and right. And rather than trying to equalize men and women and say, no, 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 the only way that it's a just society is if it's 50-50 men and women going into battle together. That's insanity. Mm-hmm. Because women are not designed by God for that role, nor are men designed by God to be in that scenario with women in that role. That's a bad way to do it, and it hinders a military from performing the functions they were supposed to do. Now, you can broaden that out to many different things. Now, with that said, I went on a bit of a tangent there that I didn't intend to go on, but that was interesting, especially because you were former military.
Yeah.
And so you probably got a lot of stories to tell about that. Let's get back to where we were. What does this mean for us? So, when I teach on the differences of men and women, what I want to encourage is I want men to lean into biblical masculinity. Because when they do that, the world is lifted up. Everyone around them is lifted up. And I want women to lean into biblical femininity. Because when they do that, everyone around them is lifted up. Now, how do we do that? Well, that's a lot of study. And the first thing to do well is to recognize that there is a difference and to open our lives with open hands, open the scriptures and say, God, what does your word say about what roles I take, how I relate to other people, what I pursue, what I find joy in? Because anywhere where I've separated myself from your good design, I want to change. And I think men, this is going to have implications for you, and women, it's going to have implications for you. I love, now this is not the only place to go in the Bible, but I love going back to the story of Ruth whenever I teach on this. Not that this is the primary moral teaching of the book of Ruth in the Bible, but in the book of Ruth, you have a man acting like a man and a woman acting like a woman, and it's beautiful. Now, what do I mean by that? The two major characters in the story of Ruth in the Old Testament are Ruth and Boaz. Now, the book of Ruth in the Hebrew Bible, our Old Testament books, in our English translations, the order of them is changed from what the original Hebrew Bible, the collection, the order it was. The book of Ruth, interestingly, comes after the book of Proverbs in the Hebrew Bible. And that's done intentionally. Josh, why is that?
Because Proverbs ends with the Proverbs 31 woman.
Proverbs 31 woman. For our listeners who don't know what Proverbs 31 is, what's Proverbs 31 all about?
It's all about what a woman at the end of her life, looking back, a godly woman, how she serves her family and her husband. That just spells out piece by piece what looking back over her life looks like.
Yeah, Proverbs 31 is this incredible ending to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs has largely been instruction to young boys. It's not that there's not tons of implications and lessons for women to learn and take away from Proverbs. Of course, I mean, it applies in tons of ways to men and women. But early on, it's written from an older man to a younger boy becoming a man, saying, here's wisdom for life. And then on the end, there's instructions to a boy who's a man now, saying, here's the kind of woman you ought to be looking for.
Yeah.
Proverbs 31 ends on this. Let me read to you some of this. An excellent wife, who can find? She's far more precious than jewels. You hear this language of biblical femininity? She's far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it's yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. If we keep going down further down here, strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Now, there's more in there than just that, but this is the picture of a godly woman. And to men who are looking for a spouse, biblical men should be looking over this not as the sole instructions for what a godly woman, there's plenty more to look at than just Proverbs 31, but you should be looking for a woman that matches these things, these qualities. Does the woman you're pursuing match these qualities? Women, what I would say is, when you look at this, do you see yourself in here? And then the very next chapter in the Hebrew Bible is Ruth chapter 1. And Ruth chapter 1, we're introduced right away to this incredible young woman named Ruth, who exemplifies a lot of Proverbs 31. And then in that story, we also meet Boaz. Now, let's see. I'm going to quiz you. I'm going to put you on the spot. Mm-hmm. You're in Hebrew right now in seminary, right?
Yeah.
What does Boaz mean? Boaz? Oh, Josh, fail. I'm kidding. Josh's Hebrew is probably better than mine.
I don't remember.
Boaz means strength. The name Boaz in Hebrew, that term literally means strength. Boaz is the epitome of strength. He's a man who exemplifies strength. Now, again, let's walk on some controversial waters. Do men have a natural strength that is greater than women in terms of muscles?
Generally, yeah.
How dare you say that?
I know. That testosterone in our bodies, it's evil.
Now, here's a good question. Here's a philosophical question for you. Did God... how do I word this well? What's the purpose of the strength? Is it accidental or is it by design? It's a, I narrowed you in.
Yeah, it's by design.
No, what do you mean by that?
Well, because of our different roles, strength, especially upper body strength, has a lot more to do with being able to protect one another, whereas physiologically, having certain hip strength and shape is better for carrying a baby than that upper body strength would be.
Okay, so Josh, what I hear you saying and what I agree with is that the actual design of our bodies, particularly men having more muscularity, having more testosterone, matches God's design for what he assigned men to do in mm-hmm. a general sense, as well as women's natural bodies have a natural design. So when we go back to the study and find naturally more empathy in women, this is not an accidental fluke of culture. This is a God-designed, natural, woven into the fabric of what we've done so that we can perform our roles to the most godly way God's designed. Yeah. Let me fly through some things here. So when we, let's stick with the men for a second. So when we talk about men, what do we see in Boaz that exemplifies godly masculinity? Now, here's the thing. Some of the things I'm going to talk about with you, I'm going to call out five qualities we see in Boaz. This isn't to say men are the only ones who can do this. There's a general sense in which all through Scripture, we see these being applied by men and instructed to men consistently. So for example, number one, Boaz takes personal responsibility for the plight of Ruth, who's in danger. Mm-hmm. Right out of the gate, Ruth's in danger in a situation where she is going through a field where other young men are in, you know, prehistoric almost days.
Yeah.
Now, why is she in danger? Because she's a young, beautiful woman. Her name literally means beautiful companion, loyal companion. She's a young, beautiful woman before there's police, before there's a National Guard, by herself trying to gather grain for her ailing widowed mother-in-law, and there's men around. What's the danger she's in? She could be raped.
Mm-hmm. So, in an open field.
In an open field.
No one around.
And that would have been the story of virtually every other woman in her position in that day and age. Boaz sees the woman, Ruth, in his field, recognizes the danger she's in, and then he takes care of her. He tells his men, he literally says, if you touch her, I'll kill you. I mean, that's not the language he uses, but basically that's what he says.
That's the communication.
He says, you touch her, you are done.
And if you let anyone else touch her, you're done.
Yeah. Now, why do the men listen to Boaz?
They respect him.
Why? Because he's a man of God. He's a man's man. And he's got some muscles to back up the words. He's a man of wherewithal. And when he says he's protecting someone, he protects him. He protects Ruth. Men, you have a responsibility to protect, to take personal responsibility. And number two, not only take personal responsibility physically, but to take personal responsibility in terms of caring for needs. Boaz then provides her with food. Mm-hmm. Here she is scrounging to get by, and Boaz says, look, I'm going to sacrifice from what I have to give you enough grain for you and your ailing widowed mother-in-law to be fine through the winter. And he gives her an abundance. Men, when you see those in need around you, there is a first sacrificial step you should take in leading, especially towards the vulnerable. In that day, it was Ruth, who was unbelievably vulnerable, Naomi, who was a widow, who was vulnerable, and Boaz steps in and defends physically and personally. He provides for her. So he defends her. He takes personal responsibility for her. He defends her physically. He provides for her, number three, through the food. Number four, he leads her in purity. Oh, this is a great one. Now Ruth, I'm going way too quick through the story of Ruth. You should read this on your own or listen to, I've done a number of sermons on Ruth. But there comes a point where it's a little bit of a, how's this scenario going to turn out?
Yeah.
Ruth approaches Boaz while he's sleeping at his threshing floor in the middle of the night because Naomi, her mother-in-law, has says, hey, go present yourself to Boaz. And it's a little bit of a risque situation. I mean, I don't necessarily think Ruth wanted to break God's law and sleep with Boaz, but she certainly goes by cover of night and she bathes, puts perfume on, and presents herself to Boaz where no one else can find. Now, the question is, what's Boaz going to do in this situation? A lot of men in that situation would have taken advantage of Ruth. They have a beautiful woman coming to them in the middle of the night, and he's sleeping where no one else will find out. What does Boaz do? He leads in purity. He says, nothing's going to physically happen tonight between you and me because we're not married yet. And my job is to lead you. Men, your job is to lead in purity. That does not mean that the women in engaged relationships or in dating relationships don't have a say. It doesn't mean that you don't work together to figure out what boundaries are. Absolutely not. Who takes responsibility for that? Men, that's on you. You lead the way in purity. And then number five, Boaz got it done. I love this one. Boaz was the man of wherewithal. He wakes up the very next day. Ruth goes home. Naomi says, and Ruth tells Naomi what happened. And Naomi says, hey, sweetheart, I know this man. He'll be back in a few hours. He's going to get the job done right now. Boaz goes to the gates and takes care of all the paperwork that's needed to get Ruth married that day. Boaz doesn't linger. Now, that's a kick in the butt to a guy like me. You know why? Because I've had a spare back windshield wiper that I need to replace the windshield wiper on my Honda Odyssey sitting in my family room in the corner for 6 months. Mm. And I have a tendency to postpone getting things done. And that's a lack of biblical manliness in me. That's a fall of sin in my life that postpones important work to take care of my family and make sure that the windshield wipers work. And we all fall in that many different ways, but Boaz got it done. Men, the picture I'm painting is one of stepping into leadership, defending physically, using your muscles for a good purpose. That doesn't just mean physically fighting people, but defending your family from ideas. Who is the guard of what's coming in? Who's setting the record straight of the Bible? This is the responsibility of the man, of the father in the house, to lead, protect, and defend. Now, women, you look to Ruth. What do we see in Ruth? In Ruth, we see this incredible, sacrificial, bold, caring, and determination to help her mother-in-law. In Genesis chapter 1, we read that woman was created to be a helper for man. Her role was not to lead the family. Her role was to serve and make sure that the family could flourish from a behind-the-scenes helping place. While the man took the headship, the woman made that headship possible by serving and blessing. In Ruth, as soon as Naomi, her mother-in-law, finds out she's widowed and that Ruth is widowed, what does Ruth do? She commits herself to Naomi.
Yeah.
She says, I'm going to help you selflessly. She leaves her mother and father in this unbelievable Proverbs 31 helping mentality and says, I'm going to help you, Naomi. And this is interesting because Naomi is not her father. Naomi is not her husband. She owes nothing to them in terms of biblical faithfulness that we would say by the law. Mm-hmm. But what does she do? She goes beyond the law and exemplifies sacrificial love towards this ailing, endangered widow.
And she shows this beautiful example of truly cleaving from her mother and father to honor her husband, who's now deceased, by honoring her husband's mother.
Uh-huh.
So that's the just the quintessential example of cleaving from mother and father in a biblical way.
Yeah. Proverbs 31 talks about a woman who, when there's need in the home, she goes out and gets it done. What does Ruth do? Well, there's no man to protect them, so they're in danger there. They have no food. Usually that would have been the man's responsibility, but here, Ruth, looking at their household that they're in Bethlehem, says, I'm going to go out and find some grain. I don't know how, but I'm going to trust God. Yeah. We find an unbelievable trust in God. He's going to provide. And then what does God do? He provides abundantly. Mm-hmm. She goes out and works with her hands and permits Boaz to bless her abundantly and is willing to receive. She doesn't see this provision by Boaz as something demeaning. Yeah. She sees it as a gift from God providing for her in her situation. It's incredible. And God provides for her.
But what would a feminist respond to this? Like, how dare he pity her by helping her out? How dare he protect her?
Mm-hmm.
And like, look how much feminism really hates women in saying that, like, we should be angry that Ruth was helped out and provided for by Boaz.
That's interesting. Yeah. So can you imagine the situation? So Ruth is in the fields. She is in actual danger. Here's what I mean. There are actual men who actually would have harmed her.
Mm-hmm.
And if Boaz went up and said, she's under my protection, and the other women said, how dare you?
Yeah.
She's a strong woman. She can protect herself. What would have happened to Ruth?
She would have gotten raped.
She would have been raped and possibly killed on that day. No doubt about it. And that's many of the stories. We actually have those stories in Scripture.
Yep, Tamar.
Right? And so again, if you fast forward to 21st century, I know the conditions are different, but the general storyline is actually, it's similar. We can draw very similar principles. What else does she do? Ruth submits to Boaz's leadership and blesses. When Ruth presents herself to Boaz and demonstrates that she's interested in this man, Boaz's response is, you have made my heart more joyful than any other point. Mm. He basically looks at her and he says, I can't wait for you to be a part of my life, not just because of your physical beauty, because of what you do, like because of how you fill me. There's a great passage in the book Song of Solomon. Oh man, I wish I had it so I could quote it. I'll have to look it up afterwards. But there's this great verse in Song of Solomon where the husband is talking about his wife, and he basically says in Old Testament language, he says, "I wear you like a medal of honor on my chest." Mm. Here's the image. When this man walks into a room full of people, he's got his armor, he's locked in arms with his beautiful bride. Yeah. And what's going through his mind?
This is mine.
This is my bride.
Yeah.
I am so proud to walk in this room with the woman of God that she is, so that every other person in this room looks out and goes, that's an amazing godly woman on his arm. Mm. And there's something wonderful about that Ruth exemplifies and that Boaz recognized right away. I want to wear you like a medal of honor on my chest. This is the beautiful complementarian relationship between men and women. She works hard. She submits to his leadership. And ultimately, what does she do? She bears a child. She bears a child that would end up being the father to Jesse, then to David, who ends up being down the line the father to Jesus.
Yeah.
This responsibility and role she had. Now, I want to be careful here because there's many women I know who struggle either with infertility, who want children, but because of physical limitations can't have children, or are not married. By no means, way, shape, or form am I saying that a woman's role is limited to childbearing whatsoever. However, biblically, that is a very important role that God has assigned to many women and a responsibility that God has assigned to many women, and we shouldn't limit that whatsoever. In the story of Ruth, that's one of the very important things that she does as she fulfills prophecy, and within the story of Scripture, that's a normal thing to be celebrated. Not to be put down, but to be celebrated. Let me just give a quick note on that. I've said this in many podcasts before. If you are a woman or a family that's struggling with infertility, can you please reach out to me? I have counseled so many families through this. This is not foreign to me. I know many families who have struggled with this, and I want to bless you and pastor you through that. At the same time, I don't want to say it means nothing. Biblically, the role women have to be nurturing, to raise a family, to bless children, to invest in their family during the day, to see their children taken care of, to see their husband taken care of. This is all part and parcel of the role that God has assigned women. Okay, Ruth and Boaz. Now, we talked about a lot here, and there's probably a lot of clarification I want to bring. So what are we saying big picture? Let's just back up. We started with this Yahoo News article that was summarizing something we already knew. There is a difference between men and women. No duh. We know that. And the crazy people today that want to say there's no difference and that womanhood is simply a man putting a wig and fake breasts on, and that's what makes a woman, that is not only a joke, but it's evil. There's way more beauty to womanhood than a man putting a wig and fake breasts on. That is a toxic, disgusting portrayal of what womanhood is. And the Bible says there's way more to it than that. There's something special about how God designed women, and there's something special about how God's designed men. And we should celebrate both and lean into both and recognize that there are pitfalls in both of them that we can and often do fall into. Mm-hmm. And we need to always hold each other accountable. There is a good God-designed difference between men and women. And we should not be confused that women have more empathy. Why would God give more empathy to women?
Because nurturing is a key part of their role.
You got it. Do we celebrate the fact that one of women's key roles is to be more nurturing, that children, the regular normal standard, obviously things happen. Sometimes I know in our church we have single parent families and we are working diligently to bless these families and to provide for these families. But under what I want to call a normal circumstance where there's a father and a mother in a home, the empathy that a mother brings into a household is of vital importance. Mm-hmm. It's of vital importance, just like the testosterone that a man brings into a household is of vital importance. Those two things should be leaned into as women nurture and care for their children, okay? And the attack on biblical manhood and womanhood that tries to rob us of these things and say, don't lean into those things, is terrible. We need to reject that as Christians and rather set the record straight by showing God's beauty.
Yeah.
Not all masculinity is toxic. Mm-mm. Not all masculinity is toxic. I've said this before. Now, I've commented on the Joe Rogan show before, and I like commenting on Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan is not a Christian, Joe Rogan actually says a lot of really foolish, terrible things all the time. Yeah. He likes drugs. He does not represent Christianity. In fact, he said a lot of terrible things about Jesus. So I am not lifting Joe Rogan up in any positive way whatsoever. But he's the most popular by like four times over, number two, commentator. He has the most popular show in all of entertainment and influence in the entire world.
Yeah.
Four times over. Number two being Tucker Carlson on Fox News. So the Joe Rogan Show is the number one show.
And
it's like 4 hours.
And he's just talking.
But why is it? Because Joe Rogan has tapped into biblical masculinity. Let me take that back. Into something inside of men that has been being told, don't go there.
Yeah.
And then Joe Rogan comes in, and not that he's biblical masculine, but he definitely is masculine.
Yeah.
And there's something
of UFC.
He's the president of UFC, right? There's something about him that guys go, okay, like he's a bit of a brute.
Yeah.
But there's something about him that I kind of like. And what I would say is, men, Joe Rogan's not your epitome of masculinity. Far from it. He is toxic in a lot of ways. Yeah. However, there's something about that he's the number one show that shows that men are craving for a chance to exert their masculinity somewhere. Where do you exert it? Exert it towards Christ. Mm. Not Joe Rogan. Yeah. Your masculinity is good. Exert it towards Christ. Number three, womanhood. Serving as a helper in the home and within the family is beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Now, there's some commentary that's needed here. First thing I want to do, without apology, I want to say something. And it's going to be controversial. Without apology, I want to say this. Women who stay home and do not pursue a career in order to bless their family at home and raise their children should not be looked down upon. And can I say this? I'm a pastor of a city, a church in the city where a lot of the women in our church have a career. And in no way, shape, or form am I limiting that, and in no way, shape, or form am I demeaning that whatsoever. I'll get to that side in just a moment. But I want to say this. Oftentimes, I have been told by the women in our church who choose to stay home because of what they believe is the biblical command for them, of what God's asking them to do, to choose to stay home, that they oftentimes feel as second-class citizens. People will ask them, well, what do you do? And they'll say, well, I'm a homemaker. And it's almost like other women could possibly look down their nose at that or say, okay.
Or they look down at their husband for being like, why would he put her in this place?
Exactly. And what I want to say is this. Actually, if we're honest, there actually is biblical precedent for this. I don't want to make it so crystal clear that says this is the only thing you can do, but I certainly also want to celebrate that decision by women and by families to do that. Now, not everyone can do that. I get it. There's circumstances. And all, of course, I get it. And I work with many folks pastoring through this. It's complicated. However, if we read the opening chapter of Titus, where am I here? Is it the opening chapter of Titus?
Chapter 2,
right here. It says, older women likewise are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They're to teach what is good and so train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home. You might translate it as homemakers, kind and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. And what I want to say is, to the women that are working at home, can you just hear me for a second? You are doing something beautiful and godly. And there should never, in any way, shape, or form, be any looking down at a woman who chooses to work at home and to raise their children. There's something beautiful and godly and good about that. And I want to celebrate the work you're doing as valid and kingdom-building and good. Now, with that, there are many women who have careers. And let me have a couple words here. So is it fundamentally wrong for a woman to pursue a career? Well, there's two camps here. There are actually some who would look at the passage I just read and in general say, yes, in a general sense, it's wrong. That is not the camp I am in. And I want to say that very clearly. I am not saying there is no place for a career for a woman whatsoever. What I am saying, though, is that when a family is looking at establishing the rhythms of their home, I'm talking about normal circumstances. We're looking at establishing the rhythms for our home. However you choose to do that, there is a way to make sure that the woman in the home is able to lean into helping her husband and nurturing their children, that that is respectful of the biblical commands, that is very important, that sometimes actually is diminished. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes there actually is a way in which a couple, a family, can look at the importance of pushing both man and woman having a career and making that the dream, that both have very successful careers, that actually limits the roles God has assigned. And what I would say is, I think there should be a prayer-filled consideration where even bringing your pastor, bringing other good friends into your home situation and saying, are we doing this well? Are we navigating our careers well in a way that honors the responsibilities God's given us towards our children to raise and disciple our kids, allowing the man and the woman to nurture our children properly? Now, how that does that, I don't want to give you specific limitations here. I would work through that individually with each family. But what I would say is, don't throw the whole idea out. Mm-hmm. Consider what this might mean. And I've worked through with many families through that altogether. Hopefully what I just said was not a landmine. I'm guessing it probably was. But you know what? I think that the Bible oftentimes puts landmines in our hearts. And the question is, how do we keep going back to Scripture and saying, let's keep reforming. Let's bring more godliness into our home. Thirdly, we should not equate male leadership with female passivity. No, that's not the idea. The idea is that not that men just domineer women whatsoever in the home at all. There's two leaders in the home, men and women. In a biblical home, men and women are loving each other, serving each other. There's this mutual submission to each other. But there's also a headship. Yeah. And men should be leading. Men should be putting boundaries up. Men should be putting the vision forward. And the woman should be joyfully submitting to the vision of her husband when that man is pursuing hard after God. I know that my wife oftentimes has counseled women around our dinner table. And she said, you know, she says, I delight in knowing that the pressure of leading this family falls on my husband's shoulders. Because I don't want that pressure on my shoulders. He's going to give an account before the Lord for the decisions he makes in leading our family. And she says, I truly delight in that. And can I tell you, I've seen that in my wife. In fact, even recently, there were some big decisions where we labored together in prayer. We worked through it. And there came a point as we were laboring through it. She said, Rafe, I just, you know, I submit to you in this. I know you've got our family's intent. And I felt that weight in that moment of,
yeah,
there's some hard calls that we got to make as a family. And that falls on the husband and the father to make those decisions. This is not to say it's a 51-49 thing. I've actually heard pastors say that husbands get 51% of the vote, women get 49. No, that's phony baloney. You won't see that language in the Bible anywhere. Husbands are the head of the household. What that means is you love and serve your wife so faithfully, so sacrificially, so bloodily, if I could use that language, the way Jesus served bloodily. What I mean by that is you'll do anything to see your wife thrive. That there is this mutual understanding you're going to make good decisions for the family, okay? Now, what are we encouraging at the end of the day? Men, lead like men.
Yeah.
There's a toxic masculinity. Run from that. Samson's a great example of toxic masculinity. He's a womanizer. He's a brute. He's a fighter. He thinks with the first thing in his mind rather than biblical counsel. Well, that's foolish. Men, you want to know how you should behave? Look to Jesus. Mm-hmm. Lead like Jesus, sacrificially. But lead. If someone's got to lead, lead the way. Men, step up, do it. Women, look to Ruth as a wonderful example of humble servant leadership. Don't buy the lie that greatness means being and achieving just like men. That is a lie. That's not true. Instead, study the Scriptures to determine what godly womanhood looks like. And if there's any area in your life where you're reading Scriptures on the instructions that are given to women and you're saying, you know what, like, I'm actually not leaning into that right now. Mm-hmm. Lean in. Lean into the other women in your church who are faithfully pursuing this. Okay. Well, we just dug into a big topic, and I want to bring us to a close here by saying thank you for listening. If you have any questions on this, I would love to wrestle through this with you. This was not intended to be a systematic approach to teaching complementarianism. I have done that, though. I'll try to provide a few links to some resources I put out there. Our church actually labored on a very lengthy document that is the official position of our church on complementarianism that I think is very generous and very, it was labored together with men and women from across the church to try to figure out what does the Scripture say on this. I'm saying nothing that we would not find in there. But I want to encourage us. This is a topic that's very important, and it's a timely one for our day. So if there's anything I've said in here that you have questions on, we actually desire for this to be a back and forth podcast. Send us your questions. Send them to us. One of the ways you can do that, what's the email address they can email?
Parkquestions@gmail.com.
Yep. Parkquestions@gmail.com. Email us your questions. We won't use your name. We'll keep it quiet who it was. But if I'm guessing when you listen to this, there's questions you have, specific details. Let us be in that with you. We want this to be more of a dialogue. If you can, give us a 5-star rating. We hope you have been blessed by this. We love you. Thank you so much. Lord willing, we'll see you next week when you tune in.